and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week we revisit Maurice Kirk, now languishing in jail in South Wales. If you remember, we've had Maurice on last year several times, talking about his exploits as a pilot and a vet. Now I'm afraid he's behind bars. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and I'll give that number at the end of the show. But we start this week with Maurice Kirk's ex-wife, Janet Kirk. Hi, Janet. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Hello, Tony.
First of all, yes, Rough Justice is the TV programme that used to be on years ago, but we don't really seem to have these television documentaries now that look into specific cases. And I think that that has led to quite a lot of miscarriages of justice taking place where people are seeking redress through the courts and they're not getting it. And no one is finding out, very few anyway. So just tell us a little bit about Maurice and why he's in prison now.
Well, Maurice should not be in prison. He has had a running battle for 22 years with the South Wales Police, and he has been trying to take them to court for various previous injustices, and therefore he is finding himself at a disadvantage trying to bring various bodies in authority to justice.
Well, that's very difficult to do from in prison, obviously, but I mean, everybody would say if they've got a relative, friend or whatever who's in jail, that they shouldn't be there, wouldn't they?
I get that point, but he has had many cases that were proved to be fabricated afterwards that he's won, and he's trying to bring the whole body of evidence against the authorities to prove his innocence.
Well, hang on a minute, because if a case has been fabricated, that's perjury, that's actually perverting the course of justice. Surely whoever's done that fabrication should be the one behind bars, not Maurice.
But it's very hard to prove that against the authorities.
Okay, so just tell us why Maurice is in prison now then.
Currently, Maurice was convicted of a minor offence, of which he should have been out in July.
So what was that?
Because of the ongoing previous case, he had been trying to get some witnesses, and he was denied that. So he went to the police station, and he asked fairly strongly about why nobody would respond to him. So then he was arrested, and he's been now arrested and in jail since October 2013. But he was then, after various, as I said, fabricated ways of, they've kept him on remand, mainly not having the case come to court. They keep on putting it off. So he's been kept on remand. He then was eventually convicted of this one minor thing when he went in the police station, frustrated, and was told that then he was banged up. And from then on, he hasn't been allowed out.
However, I mean, what about bail? Surely, I mean, you know, he's not dangerous, Maurice, is he?
No, but he was denied bail. And so we all made a considerable fuss about it. And eventually, on July the 4th, they said he was suddenly going to be in a bail hostel. And we wondered why he couldn't go back to his house. Nobody was given any reasons, but he was sent to a bail hostel in Swansea, where he'd been in Cardiff before. And he then was re-arrested, or at least he was seized, less than a week later. So he was in the bail hostel for 1 week on an hourly curfew. As a litigant in person, he found that very hard to be able to get to his paperwork and sort out paperwork.
Sorry, what do you mean by litigant in person?
A litigant in person means that he's defending himself and he's representing himself.
I mean, wouldn't it be wiser to have a lawyer do that for him? Or maybe he simply can't afford it. What's the reasoning?
He has not been able to find a lawyer in Wales. Because of what he's doing, nobody wants to be involved in this.
Oh, right. So no one was prepared to represent him.
Yes, that's right.
Well, that's very difficult. OK, take us back to the courtroom. What difficulties has he had then as a litigant in person?
Well, continual difficulties as a litigant in person in the past, but now, as a person in prison, it was extremely difficult. And then in a bail hostel, all his papers were removed to a warehouse 20 minutes away, and he was in on an hourly curfew in a bail hostel. And the other thing was, he's had a lot of health problems, and he had been promised an appointment for various abdominal pains. And while he was out at the bail hostel, he was told to go to the approved medical clinic, where that is approved by the bail hostel. And he went there twice, and that was another considerable walk. And nobody knew anything, so he was again a little frustrated, I think. But having checked on it later, nobody said he was very unpleasant. He was just frustrated. Anyway, he was suddenly seized by the police. And once you're on bail, and then you are taken back into custody, you have no appeal. And basically, you disappear. So when he should be out, we just don't know why he's not allowed out. And we get no answers.
Well, you say disappear. I mean, that's the sort of thing you expect from Pinochet's South America, not from South Wales.
Well, it seems to be like that in South Wales, for anybody who tries to take them on, shall we say.
Well, you're his ex-wife. I mean, just tell us a bit about your relationship, because it must have taken something for you to then come back and say, and then to start campaigning for his release.
Yes, well, I'm not really campaigning, because his sister's doing that, but she's not in this area. And when she asked me to do something, I do try and do what I can, because I do believe, firmly believe, he is unjustly being detained. And I think the whole system is absolutely corrupt.
Well, tell us about the background. You mentioned that he'd had a dispute, was it 15 years ago to begin with? How did this whole thing start?
I think he's saying for 22 years he's had an ongoing dispute with the law. But he went to Wales, and quite soon afterwards he found that he was having problems, but I wasn't there, so I can't report on that, really.
Well, yeah, he was practising as a vet, I believe, and yes. Running a veterinary surgery, and he had an office as part of that surgery he was leasing that he was subletting to someone who was a police superintendent in South Wales that he had a little bit of a falling out with.
Yes, and that's more recent, but yes, that's true. And starting at that point, that would be only a couple of years ago, it was sublet to a police superintendent's daughter, and unfortunately she had very unfortunate company, and with this boyfriend and the daughter, they took over the place and began not paying the rent and would not leave the place. And because she was a superintendent's daughter, a lot of trouble started from that juncture, and the boyfriend has been very hard to remove from this property, which he has trashed, and well, I haven't been directly involved, so I can't say all the details, but he's definitely, they wanted him evicted and he wouldn't go, and that's set up a lot of trouble. That's what got him arrested in October 2013,
and
again,
so
again, as well as trying to go to the police station to get the witnesses, it was also to do with that.
Okay, so are there any other things you want to tell us about the background as to why Morris is in jail now? Because this obviously stretches back a long, long time.
Yes, it goes back a long time, but now, currently, recently, he has this very agonising health problem, which he's being denied medical attention, which is really despicable.
I mean, what have you been able to do to try and help him get medical attention? Surely, you know, if a doctor has seen him, or if he thinks that he needs attention, even though he's in prison, he's got a right to see a doctor.
You would think so, wouldn't you? However, he is denied that, and he's in a wheelchair now, and he seems to there seems to be one particular probation officer, prison officer on the ward, who seems to delight in making his life a misery. And so the latest up-to-date happening has been He has had his wheelchair removed, so he can go nowhere now. And he has even been charged, please don't laugh, he has even been charged with having tried to assault a prison officer with a wheelchair, which meant he was sitting in the wheelchair. They threw him out of it onto the ground and removed it. And I should think he was assaulted, not them. And so he has had a disciplinary hearing, I think, in the last few days, which will now affect this parole that he shouldn't be there anyway, but he wants a parole hearing so he can then explain himself to a parole board, that whom he hopes will be based on some people who are more independent. He's been denied a hearing to be able to tell them the situation. And this latest happening means that the disciplinary hearing from that means that he's can't even get to this parole hearing, and he hasn't got a wheelchair, and he's suffering a lot of pain. That's the most recent, which does seem quite Dickensian, don't you believe? I think so.
Well, it certainly sounds it. Also, though, there is this tendency, isn't there, of there was something called the Stanford Prison Experiment in the United States in the 1970s or late 60s, I believe, where they actually did an experiment in the summer break at the university, Stanford University, and they found that they had to, after a couple of days, stop the experiment because the people who were playing the roles of the guards started to become very abusive towards the prisoners in the experiment, because of the situation, the power relationships that were there. It seemed to bring out the worst in people, the fact that they had so much power over the prisoners. And I wonder if you think that might be going on here, because it just sounds like the persecution that's happened to Morris, and I don't think anyone would deny that being stopped several times a week, sometimes more than once in the same day, as Morris told us about, where being asked for your documents when you're driving around by the police is a form of persecution. And for that to some sort of persecution to be carrying on within the prison seems like, you know, we're witnessing some sort of abuse of authority here.
Yes, absolutely. And although I don't know of that experiment you've described, I would say that fits the bill perfectly, and that power corrupts very often, unfortunately. And therefore, these people in a position of power can behave in the way they want, and they don't seem to be held to account.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it, about human nature, because we like to think that everyone's kind of nice by nature, good by nature, and that you have to work quite hard to be a bad person or a nasty person. And this sort of thing does make you think, well, maybe the opposite is true, that when people don't think that they're under any scrutiny, they will start to behave, you know, rather badly. And there's almost a natural tendency for people to do that when their scrutiny is down, because, of course, there is much less transparency about what happens in our jails nowadays. There's a lot less justice, because legal aid's been taken away from many, many people now as well under the coalition government. And, of course, there's very little scrutiny about what goes on inside our prisons as well as our court system. Anyway, what do you think, Janet, is the future for Morris? I know he's hoping for parole. You said there that may not happen now. So where are we right now?
I can't say exactly because I don't know. I believe his sister knows a little more than I do. But the situation is, I understand, that they seem to think they're going to hang on to him until March. He's 70 in March, by the way. And I can get absolutely no explanation why. I wouldn't say I'm campaigning, but I have written to his MP several times. And, of course, I've written to various people in Parliament. And he has various support system, I think, of people who do campaign on his behalf. And his sister is certainly there behind him. But what is the future? If he stays until March, I think his spirit will really be broken, and it is really unfair and unjust and, well, completely against the law.
Oh, have you been able to visit him?
I have seen him. I have actually also attended some court cases when he asked me to take notes. And as I am in not far to go, and that was in Cardiff because that's where he lives, and when I have done that. So I have seen him in court several times, and just recently I haven't seen him because we thought he would be out. And he was out on the, as I say, on the 4th of July until the 11th of July, he was out, and he was coming over to Bristol. And on the 11th, without any rhyme or reason, he was seized, as I just told you before, thrown back into jail, and into Swansea jail this time. So he's separated from his stuff in Cardiff, and he's in Swansea jail ever since the 11th of July.
So was he seized in Bristol here?
No, he never left.
Oh, he was heading off for Bristol.
No, he was at the bail hostel on an hourly curfew.
Ah, right.
And he couldn't leave the place then, at that point. He, as I say, it was less than a week before he was seized. So there wasn't any change of conditions or the system being slightly slackened off. He didn't know. He never left Swansea. And he didn't have a car. He was stuck there. And he just tried to get his paperwork together and have a medical appointment, and both things did not happen. And he is, I understand, in a lot of pain.
Now, the parole board hearing, is that going to happen? Do we know what's happening with him? Is he going to get parole?
We are not given the reasons. We're not given any explanation. And we don't know. And this seems to be against justice as well. In fact, the inspector of prisons, Mr. Nick Hardwick, came round doing a general inspection of prisons, and it happened to be Swansea, and I believe Morris had a chance to have a word with him, and we thought that might help matters. It helped matters in terms of prison conditions for about a week after that, and then it reverted to the power game again, of power corrupts, and he's denied privileges, and then when he objects, then he gets penalised on punishment. And the latest thing is this ridiculous story of seizing the wheelchair and then saying he's assaulted them when they take the wheelchair. It beggars belief, doesn't it? But what is the future? Hmm. Well, presumably, if nothing can be done, he should be out in March 2015.
Okay, what about communications? How have you found it trying to keep in touch with what's going on? Because obviously, it's not the easiest thing in the world to communicate with Morris or with the people who are looking after him, in inverted commas, in jail. So how have you found it? I mean, are they able to put you in touch with him on the phone? Can you speak to him on the phone?
No.
Can you find out what's happening to him from the prison?
No. I hear from his sister.
I mean, you're one of the closest. I mean, is it?
I hear from his sister.
Right, so it's second hand.
And he has, as I said, one or two support system people, including a lady called Sabine, who's in London.
We have her on this show from time to time.
Who set up a petition on his behalf. And he tries to get information to her, and he gets information to, as I said, his support system in Cardiff. And that gentleman sends me information on, and then occasionally I get a letter from Morris in the post. That's the only communication. I have sent him stuff in the post, and he sent me stuff in the post. And whether it's vetted, and whether it's censored, or whether it doesn't get there, and when I sent stamps, I understand they don't get there. But that has been the communication, the most of it through his sister, or through this chap in Cardiff, occasionally from Sabine, and letter writing, and if he's able to get letters out. When this man, Mr. Hardwick, came round, suddenly he had this wonderful week when he was allowed to use a computer and print his letters, because his handwriting is dreadful, and he got quite a lot done in that week, and I had copies of quite a lot of his stuff sent in the post, so I could read that. Since he's had all those privileges removed and the computer removed, I don't really know what's happening. His sister is trying to ring the chaplain and be in contact with the governor and the probation officer, because as his sister, she is named as the next of kin. She's the direct contact.
You used the word Dickensian, didn't you? What made you use that word?
Well, it is Dickensian. It seems to me absolutely appropriate to call it that.
What? Tell us what you mean. What you mean by it, then?
What do I think of as Dickensian? People in Victorian times were treated in prison, which was pretty diabolical. No human rights whatsoever. I think since the Human Rights Act came in, there are certain human rights that one is meant to observe in this country, but I don't think those particular rights are being given to Maurice Kirk.
Okay, and whereabouts is a good place to follow what's been happening to Maurice? Is it maybe Sabine's blog, victimsunite.net, or whereabouts can people follow what the latest is with Maurice?
Yes, Sabine has a website, I believe, and an ongoing blog then, yes. She had a petition going as well. And, his support system in Cardiff, Jeff, I'm not sure whether he's that easily contactable, but his friend Jeff's colleague, support system Jeff, he sends stuff around by email.
Okay, but I think probably the best place to start if you're interested in following what's been happening to Maurice Kirk is on www.victims-unite.net. Janet, finally, final word for you is, what would you like to see happen?
Well, I do believe in fair treatment and justice, and Maurice might have not been the easiest person, but he definitely has not been treated fairly, and I think he should be let out straight away, be allowed to have his medical problems sorted out, and be allowed to live as a free human being in this country.
Janet Kirk, ex-wife of Maurice Kirk, who's doing time apparently until middle of next year, beginning of next year. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Sleep at night.
Well, better known for a song called Fool's Gold. Who was that? It was from the album The Very Best of the Stone Roses. That was a song called I Am the Resurrection, and recorded. It's a very, very small print here on the CD, but it was recorded the same year as Fool's Gold. That's 1989. Recording now. Okay, we are.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Now, public mental health spending in England is too low, says the charity Mind. That's on the BBC website. Local authorities in England's spending is unacceptably low amount on public mental health, according to the charity Mind. A report by the charity is saying, on average, just 1.4% of public health budgets is spent on mental health. Public Health England welcomed the report from Mind and said there should be more investment at the local level. And the local government association is saying that councils have been doing many positive things that the report hadn't recognised. Public mental health includes interventions to prevent mental health problems, promote good mental health, and ensure good physical health for people with mental health issues. So that article was on the 28th of November on the BBC website. Public mental health spending in England, it's too low, says Mind, by Smitha Mundasad. But we here now have Andrew Dent to talk about public health. Andrew, I wonder, first of all, are you agreeing with Mind's analysis there that there's not enough money being spent on mental health?
Really, it's a case of relative spending. You can never, ever spend enough on something so important as mental health.
But there's so many different demands, aren't there, right? Yes. Across government, all sorts of areas. They'll say defence spending is also important. So, first of all, what made you get involved with this issue?
I guess let's go back about a year or so, and I was faced with a terrible dilemma. I had to make a decision. We'll talk about that in a moment. But it was my partner who became mentally ill and had a breakdown. And then suddenly I became interested in what mental health is, what it is to be mentally well, mentally sane, because a lot of us take mental health for granted. But there is a statistic out there that says one in four people will have at some stage some mental health issues. Maybe some may have a light mental health issue, or some may be really serious. But that's one in four, which is quite a frightening statistic.
OK, so what happened with you and your partner? Give us a bit of some more detail.
OK, we were fine for a while. And then suddenly my partner suddenly started developing strange behaviours. And it started off with a few visits to her local GP. The GP said,
what sort of behaviour? Give us an example.
Very, very compulsive. Things had to be perfect. This led to visits to the GP, and the GP said, oh, have these tablets. And that seems to be the easiest solution to any start of a mental health issue is take tablets. The tablets we think will work. And because her records were pre-digital records, it took a while to get the mental health part out of the medical records. So really, she didn't have any treatment for about 3 or 4 months. And in this period, her mental health was slowly deteriorating until she had to be admitted.
OK, so you tell us a little bit about this. Is it some sort of compulsive disorder? Just give us a bit more of a flavour of the sorts of things your partner was doing that would indicate mental health. Because for some people, these sort of things, they may consider them normal.
Well, for example, she suddenly started smoking again. And that's something she swore she'd never, ever do again. And she'd repeat things over and over again. So she felt her mental illness was
a stigma. What do you mean, saying things?
Yeah, saying things like, it's a stigma, it's a stigma.
Okay, just sort of coming out with the same thing again and again and again. Crikey, a bit pretty disturbing. So what happened when she actually started to get some real treatment rather than just the pills?
Well, the real treatment, we were seen by the Brook Centre in Bristol. It's actually a centre based in St Paul's, Bristol, and they have an emergency mental health team who will send out support workers. It's only a temporary solution, and really getting a community psychiatric nurse or a CPN is very difficult. it took a very long time to get the right treatment to her. And this is partly due to the fact that the funding is so limited.
Okay, so what help were you actually able to get?
Well, she was eventually assigned a CPN, but before this happened, she was admitted to a psychiatric unit. And at this point, she was there for...
A crisis happening before the intervention. So what were the circumstances around her actually being admitted?
Her circumstances were she stopped reacting to things and she stopped doing things for herself. So I had to do everything. I was literally her carer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And for anyone who's been through this kind of situation, it was a very difficult time for both of us. And thankfully, I mean, she has recovered since. But as I keep saying, we'll get to that later.
Okay, so once she was admitted, there was some actual proper treatment. So what was that?
Well, for the first 2 or 3 days when she was in the unit, she was given treatment, but she wasn't eating, she wasn't drinking, with the result that she went into a catatonic phase where she was literally not reacting to anything.
So what is catatonia? Is it some sort of like almost like you're frozen or something?
Yes, almost like being frozen. You won't respond to anything that's going on around you. And she was taken to the Bristol Royal Infirmary where she was just literally in a bed, not reacting to anything at all. And at this point... when she did start reacting, I had to make the decision, do I give consent to have my partner to get them to give her electrocompulsive therapy?
Right, so this is actually high voltage electric shocks through the brain, isn't it?
That's
so
correct.
That's what they said to you, that this was going to help her. So how, that's a very difficult decision to make.
Yes, really. Normally, these kinds of decisions are made by next of kin. There is a thing in the Mental Health Act which refers to the closest living relative. And in that case, the closest living relative wasn't available. And as she had actually put me down as the next of kin, it was down on my shoulders to make that decision.
Was it? Did you have to make a snap decision, or were you given a bit of time to? It's a big decision to make, isn't it?
I was given about 24 hours to make this decision.
So, how did you go about deciding?
Well, for a start, the general thing with medical issues is to do no harm. So, any treatment, as long as it does more good than harm, then that is a good thing. So I read up on various websites, trying to avoid some of the more crackpot websites which are out there. Mind was a very good source of information. And the general impression I got was when you are put under general anaesthetic to receive this treatment, you're given relaxants and stuff because it causes seizures. And the idea is to switch the brain off temporarily and switch it back on again. It's almost like rebooting a computer.
Well, isn't it kind of like a brain anaesthetic? It's like turning your brain off for a while it's being treated, then turning it back on and hoping it reboots okay.
Well, this is the interesting thing because no one actually knows why it works. There is a strong belief that it does work, and there's also a very strong belief that the whole thing doesn't do anything at all, and it's the person who believes that the treatment works. That's why it's... I'm trying to think of the word.
Placebo.
Placebo, yes.
Yeah, so the fact that you're going through a treatment of some kind actually has a... You believe you're being treated actually has quite a marked effect. Okay, so what decision did you make, and how did you actually decide to make that decision?
So I went through all the medical evidence. I had to take due process on this before I made a decision, yes or no. And one of the interesting facts that comes up is I mentioned placebos. There was a study done a few years ago by the NHS that actually showed if they did half with the treatment and half without the treatment, the outcome would have been exactly the same. So that kind of said, well, it's a placebo, it's not actually doing any harm. then the big issue that came to my mind was the fact that actually the general anaesthetic is more risky than the actual treatment itself. Now, I've been under quite a few general anaesthetics myself, so I know there's actually zilch risk if you do the various tests that you have to do before that general anaesthetic is administered. So weighing up all the evidence, I decided, well, we might as well try it, because if it doesn't work, then there's always something else which can be tried.
Okay, so what was the result then?
She actually got better. I'm not saying it works. It doesn't work in every situation. And there is very documented evidence that shows that after, for a period up to 6 months, a patient can actually regress back again. So I'm just keeping a tab to make sure this doesn't happen.
So was it literally almost straight away as soon as she'd had this treatment? I mean, I kind of, if you go online and look for Ewan Cameron, it's pretty sinister stuff. In the United States, Ewan Cameron was experimenting on people with this electroconvulsive therapy with the idea of almost like resetting the brain to childhood. He was a very strange character, and I think very unethical in the methods that he was using and the patients he was selecting without actually telling them what he was doing to them. But what he was saying was that, look, by essentially putting these electric currents in someone's brain, you can almost erase their memories and try and reset them. Now, some of the people, you know, this was done to in a very unethical way. So there is a lot of controversy around this. Do you still feel happy about having agreed to it?
I feel I did the right thing looking at the evidence. I also know that there is a very big cliche when it comes to this kind of treatment, and a lot of people will call up images of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Now, that film was made in the 70s, but the actual treatments featured in that film were things which were more common in the 50s and in the 70s. So when the film was made, it was actually out of date already. And maybe there's a lot of things, because with mental illness, it's not a case of I've got a broken leg, it's in a cast. You cannot see a mental illness. You can only see it through the actions and behaviour of a person who is mentally ill.
Now, some people will say actually using electricity is not the best way to deal with mental illness. For a lot of people, it's a spiritual thing, and that, you know, you need to talk to a vicar maybe, or, you know, somebody, something going on in your spiritual life. What are your thoughts about that, and did you consider that as a possibility?
I considered CBT, which she was far too way gone by the time we got her onto a CBT course to actually have any influence on her.
Sorry, but what is that?
That is cognitive behavioral therapy, which tries to address the cognitive responses of a person and change negative thinking. So
it sounds almost like physiotherapy for the mind.
Yes, it is.
If we can call it that. But so anyway, have you actually tried that or not?
Yes, we have tried that. I'm hoping to get her back into a course of CBT at some stage.
And what about the general idea of mental health? What do you think? I mean, someone who maybe hadn't had a lot to do with it before and suddenly it's on your doorstep.
It's something that people shouldn't be afraid of, but it's something that can be treated very easily, like any other illness.
Do you think ideas are outdated about it?
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
And what do we need to learn?
I think we need to learn a certain amount of tolerance. But there are certainly organisations like Mind, for example, who do a lot of very good work to improve our understanding of mental health issues. But really what's needed, as I said, was funding. The mental health services are terribly underfunded. And by putting the funding in, money isn't everything, but it certainly does make a difference.
Well, it sounds to me from what you're saying that the mental health, the actual help, was only there after the crisis hit. Now, that could be really dangerous. As someone who's having a mental health crisis, they may not actually come out of it alive. Some people, you know, really going over the top. So is that fair to say?
Yes, it is fair. Unfortunately, it took about 2 or 3 months until we were taken seriously and the treatment was made available.
Well, I mean, it probably wasn't just that you weren't taken seriously. That is that the case became so drastic that they finally had to do something, which is a great pity. Anyway, so thanks for sharing all that with us, Andrew. Anywhere you would suggest, finally, as a sort of one-stop shop for anyone that's having real difficulties actually accessing mental health care?
I would suggest looking online and looking at Mind's website. There are various organisations who offer CBT as courses, and those are very, very helpful. The Samaritans will always talk to people who are going through issues, even though they can't give solutions. At least having someone to listen to you is half the battle, and maybe that's a way forward for a lot of people.
Okay, well, the website is mind.org.uk if you want to go there. And you had a pretty good experience with them?
Yes, they're being very helpful.
Okay, Andrew Dent, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And Mind's phone number is 0208 519 2122. That's 0208 519 2122. And I'll give that number again at the end of the show.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Back now to University of California, Berkeley in 1962, and a speech entitled The Ultimate Revolution, that people may love their slavery. Quite a chilling talk by the author of Brave New World, and it's Aldous Huxley. And he starts this week's excerpt by talking about hypnotism.
If everybody were extremely suggestible, then dictatorship would be absolutely inevitable. I mean, it's very fortunate we have people who are moderately suggestible in the majority and who therefore preserve us from dictatorship but do permit organized society to be formed. But once given the fact that there are these 20% of highly suggestible people, it becomes quite clear that this is a matter of enormous political importance. For example, any demagogue who is able to get hold of a large number of these 20% of suggestible people and to organize them is really in a position to overthrow any government in any country. And I mean, I think this, after all, we've had the most incredible example in recent years of what can be done by efficient methods of suggestion and persuasion in the form of Hitler. Anybody who's read, for example, Bullock's Life of Hitler comes forth from this with a sort of horrified admiration for this infernal genius who really understood human weaknesses, I think, almost better than anybody, and who exploited them with all the resources then available. I mean, he knew everything. I mean, for example, he knew intuitively this Pavlovian truth that conditioning installed in a state of stress or fatigue it goes much deeper than conditioning installed at other times. This was why all his big speeches were organized at night. He speaks of this quite frankly, of course, in Mein Kampf. He says this was done solely because people are tired at night and therefore are much less capable of resisting persuasion than they would be during the day. And we see in all his techniques, he was using... He had discovered intuitively and by trial and error great many of the weaknesses which we now know about in a sort of scientific way, I think much more clearly than he does, than he did. But the fact remains that this differential suggestibility, this susceptibility to hypnosis, I do think is something which has to be considered very carefully in relation to any kind of thought about democratic government. I mean, if there are 20% of the people who can really be suggested into believing almost anything, as evidently they can be, then we have to take extremely careful steps to prevent the rise of demagogues who will drive them on into extreme positions and then organize them into very, very dangerous armies, private armies, which may overthrow the government. Well, this, as I say, is in this field of pure persuasion, I think we do know much more than we did in the past, and obviously we now have mechanisms for multiplying the demagogue's voice and image in a quite hallucinatory way. I mean, the television and the radio, Hitler was making enormous use of the radio. He could speak to millions of people simultaneously. This alone, of course, creates an enormous gulf between the modern and the ancient demagogue. And the ancient demagogue could only appeal to as many people as his voice could reach by the yelling at his utmost, but the modern demagogue can touch literally millions at a time. And of course, with the multiplication of his image, he can produce this kind of hallucinatory effect, which is of enormous hypnotic and suggestive importance. But then there are various other methods which one can think of, which have, thank heaven, as yet not been used, but which obviously could be used. There is, for example, the pharmacological method. This was one of the things I talked about in Brave New World. I invented a hypothetical drug called Soma, which, of course, could not exist as it stood there because it was simultaneously a stimulant, a narcotic, and a hallucinogen, which seems unlikely in one substance. But the point is that if you applied several different substances, you could get almost all these results even now. And the really interesting thing about the new chemical substances, the new mind-changing drugs, is this, that whereas, if you look back into history, it's clear that man has always had a hankering after mind-changing chemicals. He has always desired to take holidays from himself. But the most extraordinary fact of all is that every naturally occurring stimulant, narcotic, sedative, or hallucinogen was discovered before the dawn of history. I don't think there is one single one of these naturally occurring ones which modern science has discovered. Modern science, of course, has discovered better ways of extracting the active principles from these drugs, and, of course, has discovered numerous ways of synthesizing new substances of extreme power. But the actual discovery of these naturally occurring things was made by primitive man, goodness knows how many centuries ago. There is, for example, in the underneath the lake dwellings, the early Neolithic lake dwellings, which have been dug up in Switzerland, we find poppy heads, which looks as though people were already using this most ancient and powerful and most dangerous of narcotics, even in the days before the rise of agriculture, so that man was apparently a dope addict before he was a farmer, which is a very, very curious comment on human nature. But the difference, as I say, between the ancient mind changers, the traditional mind changers, and these new substances is that they were extremely harmful, and the new ones are not. I mean, even the permissible mind changer, alcohol, is not entirely harmless, as people may have noticed. The other ones, the non-permissible ones, such as opium and cocaine, opium and all its derivatives, are very harmful indeed. They rapidly produce addiction and in some cases lead at an extraordinary rate to physical degeneration and death. Whereas these new substances, this is really very extraordinary, that a number of these new mind-changing substances can produce enormous revolutions within the mental side of our being, and yet do almost nothing to the physiological side. I mean, you can have an enormous revolution, for example, with LSD-25 or with the newly synthesized drug psilocybin, which is the active principle of the Mexican sacred mushroom. You can have this enormous mental revolution with no more physiological revolution than you would get from drinking two cocktails.
That was Aldous Huxley, the author of Brave New World, in a speech he gave at the University of California, Berkeley, in 1962, called The Ultimate Revolution. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectsradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Andy Dent, Janet Kirk, and you just heard Aldous Huxley, and of course the studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do so through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. And also the number for Mind, as promised, 0208 519 2122. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Chill with your old lady at the tilt. I got